Hi, I'm Angie Hicks, co-founder of Angie, and one thing I've learned is that you buy a house, but you make it a home. Because with every fix, update, and renovation, it becomes a little more your own. So you need all your jobs done well. For nearly 30 years, Angie has helped millions of homeowners hire skilled pros for the projects that matter, from plumbing to electrical, roof repair to deck upgrades. So leave it to the pros who will get your jobs done well.
Angie, the one you trust to find the ones you trust. Find a pro for your project at Angie.com.
Hey, it's Ryan Seacrest here, and I have discovered a fun new escape from the daily grind, Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has hundreds of social casino-style games and it's all free to play anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. So get to chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 21 plus.
Hello and welcome to this interview. I'm Harry, joined today by a very special guest, quote, the most dangerous identitarian on the European right, Martin Sellner, who's here to talk today about his latest book, Remigration, published by Passage Press, and the general prospects of remigration and a positive identitarian movement across Europe. Thank you very much for joining me today, Martin.
Thanks for having me.
And it's great to have you too. So for people who aren't aware, you have been involved within identitarian movements, particularly in Germany and Austria, for a very long time now. You have grown quite notorious, not that I'm judging you for that at all. Question, are you still barred from Germany and Great Britain? Because I think I remember that Theresa May's government barred you from here. Is that still in effect?
Yes, the United Kingdom, yes. Germany, not anymore. I've successfully fought the travel ban to Germany and Switzerland. And currently, I think I have a standing travel ban to the United Kingdom and to the United States of America.
To the US as well, even under Donald Trump. That is quite shocking, but quite sad to hear. But we're able to still talk despite all of that, and we're able to still spread our ideas. So that is something positive about the information system that we have set up at the moment. So for those in the Anglosphere who may be less aware of you, because you're not able to come over here, you're more well known on the continent, as far as I can tell. Before we get into the details of your book, Remigration, which is being published in English, I believe for the first time, how long have you been involved in remigration activism, and what got you involved in identitarianism, particularly given that you are of a German-Austrian background, given the whole politics of guilt and the holdover of the guilt holdover from the Second World War related to that? It must be quite difficult to break out of that politics growing up in Austria, growing up around other Germans. I'm interested in just a little bit of biography of how you managed to get into it and how you managed to break out of the kind of mindset that modern Germany, modern Austria would want you to stay in.
You're absolutely right here, especially as an Austrian. Like, the amount of comments I get as an Austrian being very active in Germany. So you can imagine what people claim all the time. And yes, Germany and Austria have been hit maybe the hardest when it comes to the politics of guilt and white guilt and self-loathing. But this also, in a way, turbocharged the need for something new. So we are a new right-wing activist movement, Generation Identity, created 2012 in France. And then very recently after that, we imported it to Austria, and I could play an important role, thank God, in spreading the whole movement across the continent. And some people might still remember the big actions we did. We chartered a boat and went to the Mediterranean to hinder human traffickers there. We blocked a smuggling pass in the Alps. But obviously, due to the success in 2020, we were totally nuked and vaporized. So I'm banned from any social media platform, YouTube, Instagram, Facebook, TikTok, and also I've been debanked 116 times. So this was the reaction, I would say, of the system to this new plan and to this new approach of activism, which was very successful. It means we are new right, so we don't see ourselves in the footsteps of any totalitarian ideology of the 20th century. We always show our faces, our actions are always non-violent, non-aggressive, creative, sometimes even funny, like street theater. And also, in terms of our goals and our ideology, we focus on the most important issue, which is demography. And since 2012, we have been raising the alarm for the Great Replacement, for replacement migration, and we've been demanding remigration since 2016. And I'm very happy, very pleased, also very proud that by a combined effort, we made it possible that in spite of all this censorship, debanking, deplatforming, remigration really took off after COVID. So that's what we're doing. I'm an organizer, I'm an author, I'm an activist, and I see myself as a remigration ambassador.
Thank you. And with that, that is quite shocking, everything that's been done to try to censor you. Given that, as you say, demography and replacement migration of Europeans, particularly within their ancestral homelands, but also within the larger nations that they've set up elsewhere in places like the United States and even in places like Australia, that is the big issue. And they've tried very, very hard to censor you from speaking about it, despite the fact that, and doing anything about it, despite the fact that, you, like you say, your activism is specifically non-violent. You are trying not to hark back to any of the totalitarian movements of the 20th century on the left. All right, why is it that you think that despite that, you are still censored in this way by the regime and by the establishment? Why is it that just saying no to your own displacement is seen as the most dangerous thing in our current politics?
I think it's not despite that, it's because of that. One left-wing journalist once wrote, we, the identitarians, are that dangerous because we are so harmless, or in their eyes, because we appear so harmless. So we don't fit into the cliché. It's very hard to use us as a scarecrow to scare people away from the identitarian issue. And I think it was really due to our success and very successful approach that we were hit so heavily by the censorship hammer. And also, I think there's a very peculiar and important thing to identitarian activism and actions. We had a lot of YouTube channels, influencers online, but for us, the call to action is not so much subscribe, share, and donate, but get active yourself. So I was trying to get people out of the online right sphere onto the street, onto the ground. We have training camps, summer training camps. We have rhetoric academies where people are being taught how to speak to journalists. We are organizing movement cells everywhere in Germany on the continent. We are organizing big demonstrations because I think it's very important to not just talk online about the issue, not just report about it. That's very important, obviously, the info war, but we also need some ground game. And that's what generation identity stands for. And obviously, as you said, it's crazy that today, just standing up for your own identity, just loving your own people, it's okay to be white, remember this this genius poster campaign, is seen as the biggest crime. But it also shows us, I would say, the big game plan of the globalists, the demographic replacement is irreversible. And I see everything else apart from the great replacement and remigration as a distraction right now. Because every other issue, economic issue, cultural issue, is, in my opinion, futile and completely worthless once we've become a minority in our own nation. Then we are facing a Lebanese scenario, a South African scenario, and we have a time frame of about 10 to 15 years to still prevent this in the UK, in France, in Germany. And so that's why we're now totally focusing on this term. We are organizing the Remigration Summit in Europe. We are organizing and unifying the whole remigration movement. We're offering policy ideas, but we also want the people who are watching this, the millions of Europeans who are now for remigration, to get active, to organize them. Because I think organization is the real acceleration. Only if you organize people, if you can transfer the vibe, the virality, the memes into a real political lobby, a real movement, then we can achieve remigration.
That's excellent to hear. You've actually presaged one of the questions that I was going to get to, which was that I was going to ask if you saw that there, because I see it sometimes as well, because I'm very active in the online spheres, of course, working the job that I do. And I see it all the time where there is an excess of energy online, but that doesn't always translate out onto the ground. Now, in Britain, there is the new party Restore Britain, which was started by Rupert Lowe, who have been going out of their way to get people out and canvassing for things like the local Makerfield by-election that's going to be coming up very soon to see if they can get MPs in. And there seems to be a big swell of positive response to people wanting to get out and do that. So in the past, I see I suppose the question is, I've seen in the past that people get way too insular online, people get way too invested in just being online meme posters, and sometimes that can get them kind of down a negative place. I've indulged in it as well, where you go down edgy posting and you think it's really cool getting loads of likes and retweets on Twitter because you said the edgiest thing that you could, where that doesn't actually impact the real world. And in fact, it could negatively impact your future prospects by making you more difficult to work with because people don't want to be associated with that kind of presence. Do you see that kind of online insulation that people found themselves in and overindulging in edgy posting? Do you see that as something that's starting to fall away and people are getting more involved in the ground game, people are getting more interested in taking it to the ground and doing things and organizing in a way that actually matters and makes a difference?
Absolutely. I think you've perfectly summarized all the threats and pitfalls with being a solely online movement. First and foremost, I think it's very easy for a political opponent to completely survey everything. So everything that happens online, Discord chat groups, can be totally surveilled and it can also easily be manipulated. So in Germany, we know by a fact that all of these Telegram chat groups are infiltrated. Many of these periodic Telegram groups are run by federal agents. There was an investigation by the AfD and we got this official information. So it's also very easy to infiltrate them and then to get them entangled in all kinds of criminal activity and in the end just to ban them. And also I think we have a bit outmaxed the info war on the online right. There are so many podcasts now. It's amazing that they all exist, but you see it especially in American right. It's very hard now to get any attention by just telling the truth. So you have to create outrage. You have to create boxing fights. You have to stage all kind of drama to get the attention and the clicks. And also it's a very bad feedback loop. The only way to get attention online is to say the most outrageous thing. So it's the brave thing to do there. So you have a race to the most radical fringes, which you then cannot transform in the public. So it's very healthy for activists to actually talk to normal people, to boomers when they hand out leaflets, because then they understand what people really want to hear and how to really get your message across. So I think what we need right now is to take this vibe, to take this virality, this domination we have in the meme war and in the online sphere, and to transform it first into a political movement on the ground. It started with Raise the Colors in the UK, and now I think Restore has done an amazing job of getting people really on the street and starting a street movement, and also with to turn it into a political lobby. A political lobby organization. That's exactly what I'm trying to do now with the Institute for Remigration. It's an NGO I'm starting in June in Europe, and it aims to become like the National Rifle Association in America, but just for remigration. So the first lobby for indigenous Europeans in Europe, because very often right-wingers complain about foreign lobbies, powerful lobbies who are influencing our government on foreign behalfs. And I completely get this, but the only solution is to become a lobby ourselves. And we need to get away just from the attention economy, from dopamine, clicks, and likes. We need to create a real organization on the street with real people, and we need to turn to a political lobby that can reward and also punish right-wing politicians if they embed our goals or if they water down ideas once they're in power. So I think that's the most important strategic goals right now for the European and for the online right.
That's really exciting because you've actually, again, kind of foreshadowed something that I've been worried about for a long time, which is the idea that, and I suppose I'll have two questions off of the back of this, so just to bear with me for a moment, if you'll allow me. I've been worried about the fact that in terms of organizational and patronage networks, the left has had the right outclassed at this point, or at least shall we say, the non-establishment, non-containment right, outclassed for decades at this point. The left have professional activist classes because they have organizations that will employ them and they will have patronage networks funded by billionaires, the most notorious of which, of course, being George Soros, who are more than happy to funnel as much money as is necessary into these organizations so that they can get their agenda put forward and made reality rather than just pure theory. The right's been good on theory for a long while, but that is somewhere where we've really needed to catch up. So it's really exciting to hear that you're involved in organizing something that is trying to create these networks and organize in a way that's going to be effective. So off the back of that, the questions will be, one, how do you attract patronage to a network like that? And two, how do you avoid the pitfalls of making it so that the patronage aren't simply trying to co-opt your own movement? Because there is also the threat, if big money comes in, they have their own ideas and their own wants. How do you avoid being co-opted by that?
That's actually a very good question. I agree. That's something we're really lacking. So we're lacking this funding and giving culture. But if you look at the potential we have, so Just Invest in Europe, you have combined with the UK, 95 million voters of right-wing parties. And if you have the average amount of leisure and luxury spending for 1 week, it's a huge budget that's out there. And people are already donating, but they're donating to this little organization, to this little streamer. So I think the right also needs incubators, fundraising networks and meetings where big money can come together. And then this money can be distributed to diverse organizations. Obviously, I completely agree with you. With this, you also have some kind of, at least the possibility of becoming dependent. But here, I think it's important to have full transparency. And in the end, it's also very clear, and it shows immediately whom you're working for by your positions and by what you're doing. So for example, what we're doing is completely funded by private donations, but these private individuals donate to us and support us because they like what we do. And I think that's the most democratic thing ever. And I think in the end, it's very important for these organizers to not become totally dependent on one big donor. So for example, also for Institute, I don't want one guy who totally bankrolls us. I rather have swarm donations, crowdfunding of more several smaller donors. I agree, that's a pitfall here. But to be honest, I think it's a risk we need to take when we want to become professional. Because obviously, to create professional institutions, we also need some kind of money. We need people who are doing this as a job. We need community organizers. And I think in the end, there's a huge hidden potential here with all the podcasters and influencers. If they would all whistle one tune, speak one language, have one perfected wording, then we could increase and multiply our effectiveness. And you've seen it with the term remigration. Was for the first time, we have this one term, which is becoming a mobilizing myth. So the problem, all these little demands of more deportations, closing the borders here and there, but now suddenly we have one term, like left has socialism or communism. And we need to operationalize this and repeat this. We need to create terms, mantras, and repeat them over and over again, but on the European level. And then suddenly our reach and also our impact, our velocity will completely explode. And that's also something we want to do with the Institute. So I think what we're lacking right now is not so much numbers, also not really money and funding. It will be there. It's always there. Once you have a great project, you always get the donors. What we really are lacking now is organization, people who are creating these ideas and trying to establish these networks.
Yes, it's about getting positive slogans. Because, you know, like as much as it makes people like us cringe, diversity is our strength has been such a pervasive slogan that's permeated all of the media. And it's been to the point where you can probably get into an argument with somebody on the street who is a leftist, and that is just a stock phrase that they will throw out to you because it's so it's an earworm and they've seen it everywhere. So we need like equally catchy like marketing as that. Once we're all organized, we've got remigration, and we need more off of the back of that, because that gets in people's minds and it solidifies the idea into something that they can just roll straight off the tongue. So that's great to hear. And on that, we'll talk about your book, Remigration.
If I may just quickly add here, to really understand and grasp the huge success of left is to look at the term like hate. If I would tell you right now, I'm organized in a hate network or an NGO that fights online hate. You, even though you're a right-winger, would immediately assume I'm on the left. So they've managed this association, also repeated by us, to associate a term like hate, which is a negative emotion nobody likes, with a political conviction, with political arguments like shutting down the borders, reducing migration, revoking citizenship. This is now totally associated to this emotional term. And this didn't happen by accident, it happened by design. And I think it's also now something we need to fight back on this level. We need to create our own metapolitical, our own linguistic strategy. And then we all need to rally behind that if we want to really conquer the debate. Sorry for...
No, that's absolutely fine. You were right to put in there. That was a great point off the back of it, because you immediately made me think of, you're probably very familiar with Hope Not Hate in Britain. They've probably targeted you yourself. Because you hear that and you know immediately who they are by the way that they are saying hope not hate means leftism, not right wing, not rightism, is essentially what you could say that is a synonym for. So we need to have our similar own slogans and monopolized terms where people will be able to hear it and have positive connotations towards us immediately spring into their mind. And on the back of that, again, let's move on to your book Remigration, because I see your work, and thank you again for sending me a forward copy of it from Passage Press, the English translation of it. I understand that you wrote it a few years ago now, but this is the first time that it's been published in English. I found your work, having read this book now, to be some of the best analytical work in describing what the problems are and what needs to happen, in the same way that you've been doing with this discussion so far. Anytime that I was reading through and found that I might have an issue where, oh, he's going a bit vague here, I'm going to need to ask for some clarity regarding this point, the next paragraph or the next section of the book would have a very well-written and comprehensive answer to the question that I was going to ask. So I appreciate the fact that you are clearly in a very analytic mindset with that, and that's the kind of work that we need being done towards remigration efforts. But in it, I thought one of the most interesting things, and I think, it would be interesting getting your perspective as an Austrian here, is the fact that one of the first things that you discuss in the book is the idea of identitarian politics. And you state quite rightly that every politics has an identitarian aspect to it. A lot of politics is almost purely identitarian. And what we have been subject to since the end of the Second World War, particularly in your case as an Austrian and your next door neighbours in Germany, has been a very negative identitarian policy. We've been fed a very negative view of our history. In your corner of Europe, that's been because of the Second World War and the Holocaust and other things that have been wielded against you and held over your head. In my country, in Britain, it's been the British Empire, decolonization. But you've been talking about building a positive identitarian politics for Europeans. How have you found that within your native Austria? And what have you been finding to be successful strategies for getting particularly young people today to have a more positive view of their own identity, their own culture, and their own history without, again, leaning into or playing into any stereotypes the left might have of us just being racists and mindless bigots and hateful?
I think it's I'm very happy you mentioned this. So thank you for that, because I think that's one of the most important points of the book. Because obviously you have a lot of very good migration policies right now, but where it differs, my book, it goes to the root, or at least tries to go to this root, to give you a view on the bigger picture. As you said, every nation has identity politics. It's politics is identity politics necessarily, because politics comes from a community. It's the ruling of a community, and a community needs a certain understanding of who they are and who the others are. And for that, you need to have an identity. And every nation also has a demographic policy, obviously. And the thing today is, these are the only taboos in our society. To talk about demography, migration, birth rates, and to talk about our identity. Who are we as Anglo-Saxons, as Austrians? What does it mean to be British, to be Austrian? These are the big taboos. All the other issues like economy, data protection laws, transparency, AI, you can have a very vivid debate about that. But these two taboos, they are hidden away like the forbidden tree in the Garden of Eden. And that's exactly why we need to touch them. And we need to overcome this self-loathing. Because if you hate yourself and if the hatred of your own kind is institutionalized, every political measure to save this kind by increasing birth rates, by having a welcome policy for your own children is also in a way impossible, because people say that's extremist, racist, national socialist in Austria. So we need to overcome this. And remigration in the end is a software issue, not a hardware issue. So all the things about logistical ideas, about legal questions that I address in the book are secondary, primary. It's the questions overcoming this will to death and replacing it with a will to life. And this, the real strategy for this, I think you're completely right, is not to go back into an ideology of supremacy, into a real ideology of hatred, but, and that's what we offer as identitarians, an idea of ethno-pluralism. So we accept all differences, we really like and appreciate different cultures, and what we want to defend is the right to exist for our own culture and to really increase and instill the love for your own nation and people in history, in young people, is to teach them this history. So what I really like about this new reel and TikTok culture is when people really see the beautiful things of our past, the buildings, the battles, the heroes. That's amazing, because we haven't been taught about this at all. So we have completely forgotten this. And I'm, as a millennial, I did not have TikTok and Instagram when I grew up. So I was force-fed these stereotypes from MTV and from all the movies. And now suddenly this is breaking up. Technology is disrupting this one-way propaganda channels, and there's a whole young generation of Zoomers waking up to the glory and the beauty of our past. And this will instill a love to protect this, because you can only protect and save what you love in the first place. So I think that's a very good strategy. But also I have to say, as an identitarian, it's important that it doesn't tilt in the other extreme direction, again, into an ideology of supremacy and real hatred, because I think this would make it very hard, in the end, impossible to have a real political change. So what we need to is to love our nation. Our nation needs to totally come first, be completely proud of our ethno-cultural continuity, try to preserve it, but also respect all the others. And that's exactly what identitarian stands for.
Well, that's fantastic. And I mean, that's what you're talking about with reminding people where we come from, our history, our achievements, our culture. It reminds me, I did an interview earlier this year with Dr. Ricardo Duchesne, the Canadian professor, on his book Greatness and Ruin, which was going through the various different achievements that Europeans have created over the millennia. It's kind of similar to Charles Murray's book on human accomplishment, where he's talking about, you know, human accomplishments and the development of all of these different philosophies and sciences and practice. And music is one of my big ones, being a musician myself. And one of the interesting things about it is part of the problem of how we've got to where we are, particularly with this negative identity politics, is that part of an imperial globalizing mindset that our elites have gotten into since the end of the Second World War seems to have been a project to universalize all of our accomplishments and bring the rest of the world into them, which seems to be a very strangely like pathological altruism. Like you breach into sub-Saharan Africa and you see that the people there have not reached the same civilizational heights that we have, so we need to bring them over to here and bring them up to what we consider to be our standards and our levels, and we have to sacrifice everything of our own, including our own identity, to do so. It's this weirdly Europeanized and Eurocentric view of how the rest of the world can do better. We have to go into Africa and make them into kind of like idealized African versions of Europeans. It's a very strange idea, but this kind of universalizing tendency could be one reason that we've got here, where what you're saying is that we can recognize the achievements of Europeans. And I really did find reading that book very instructive on just reminding me how much as a broader people that we've all achieved. But we don't have to hold everybody else to be like, you're worse because you've not been European. We don't have to kind of flatline every other culture and turn it into the grey sludge as globalization as globalization has. And that is one idea on why we're facing mass migration right now, this kind of universalist, globalist project that's kind of an offshoot of old-fashioned European imperialism. But similarly, to understand how to solve the problem, we do need to understand the causes. So for your own, from your own perspective, what do you see as the causes of our current suicidal trajectory with mass immigration into Europe, into Australia and New Zealand and America and Canada? Would you see it as being this kind of misplaced universalizing tendency, some kind of misplaced white guilt over the Second World War and imperialism? Some would suggest that it would be an economic reason, the idea that the globalist capitalist class wants to simply chase profits and wants to turn people into consumers. What do you see as the reason?
I think you hit it really the nail on its head. And it's also my own analysis. I've also been writing about this, thinking about it. So what actually interests me is philosophy. I also did my bachelor in philosophy and was really studying those issues because I really wanted to understand where does this death wish come from? Because obviously it's too big, it's too global. Every post-Christian white and only the post-Christian white civilizations are affected by it. So it cannot be the propaganda of the victors of Second World War, which initially a lot of people fought in Germany because it also hits the victors of Second World War. And also distinct groups who are profiting from the Great Replacement and from the self-destruction of white people. Yes, they might have a role and you can talk about this, but again, it's too global and too strong. And all these interest groups have been existing also for hundreds of years, and suddenly this is happening. So I think it really, you have to go back into the history of ideas. And I think this self-hatred is, again, a hidden universalism, a hidden idea of still supremacism, in a way even, because you had a lot of, like waves of universalism, religious universalism, civilizational universalism. And today it's universalism of guilt. Because what white people, and especially German people, still insist on is that our guilt is supreme. We are the masters of the universe. Everything that's bad in the world is happening by our deeds and by our omissions. So if people are suffering anywhere, it's because we, as the masters of the universe, didn't lift them up. A developing country is a country on the way to our standards. So it's all our fault. And this, of course, takes away agency of our people. So what I think to overcome white guilt, we need to throw out this idea of being chosen, of being the center of the universe, the center of history. We need to throw off the white man's burden in a way. So we need to find ourselves again, and we need to understand we don't have to have this universalistic mission and this universalistic responsibility to justify our own existence. Because the problem is, and this also really happened in the past of Europeans, that these missions and also our power and our stand in the world was mostly and sometimes only justified by this universalistic abstract mission that we did. And once this mission was gone, suddenly we had no sense to live anymore and also no justification to exist anymore. And now in the nihilistic, materialistic state of the European, suddenly all of this is turned against ourselves. So we are still on the top of the hierarchy, but we're on the top of the guilt, on the top of the of the evilness hierarchy, so to say, but still this gives us a very strong identity. So in the end, it's an identitarian question because we need to find a different identity, a different sense, a different purpose as English people, as German people, as white and European people in the world, apart from universalism. And the real reason, I think, why guilt and this ideology of guilt is so popular among Europeans is it gives you a very strong sense of identity. And today, if you grow up and go to a German university, either you become a post-identitarian global citizen of the world, a businessman, you know, who only takes care of himself, or if you're looking for a purpose, what does it mean to be German European? You immediately encounter this ideology of guilt, which gives you a very strong identity, and suddenly it means something to be German again. So in the end, this guilt is very identitarian, very folkish, even say so, because it is directly linked to your own biological heritage and your ethnocultural history. So this needs to be overcome. We need to find a different identity that really overcomes this expansive universalistic ideology and again throws off the white man's burden, because we don't have to justify our existence by having the major role in any kind of universalistic global operation.
Yeah,
if this makes sense.
No, that does make sense. It's very interesting how you pointed out how it's like it's almost like it's the new German, it's the new Austrian reason for being, the folkish concept that unites you all, that you can recognize by biology. Because I'm sure that we get new British people in all of the time. You get new Germans and new Austrians into your country all of the time. But I'm sure if it ever came to, and I'm sure if you pointed out, well, this person arrived here yesterday, he's not Austrian, the people would act with shock and horror. Are you even suggesting such a thing? But if you were to then suggest, well, if he is just as Austrian as me, then he should feel just as guilty as the rest of us about the Second World War, all of a sudden they would know straight away, wouldn't
they? Exactly. Sometimes I troll left-wing journalists and they ask me, what is a real German? How do you define a real German? And my answer is, a real German is somebody who feels guilty for his past.
There you go.
Well,
I don't
head
think
explosion.
I bet it's like in Britain, like we get the new British and then we're told, oh, they're just as English as the rest of us. And that we got told with Rishi Sunak as prime minister, we were told, oh, he's English. And then you point out then, okay, so given that he's of Indian background but is also English, is he owed £45 trillion in reparations, or do we owe, or does he owe India £45 trillion in reparations? Which is it? And I think when you ask a question like that, you suddenly get your answer. Very quickly. But it's interesting how we talk about how it's all based around this politics of guilt, because you talk about the different problems that would be resolved through a program of remigration across all of Europe. And that would be economic, that could be structural, that could be housing issues, that could be environmental issues. But one problem that we see faced by young people especially every single day these days, it's been commented on by so many people, is the mental health crisis. So many young people are growing up with this horrible self-image. They've got anxiety, and there are any number of reasons that experts will point towards for why that is. But one that they always count out is the overbearing psychological weight of this sense of guilt that's foisted on them from a very young age. So one of the positive aspects of a positive identity movement would be that you're able to alleviate that psychological weight that's keeping so much pressure on you all the time. There's been studies done into it, remarked on by people like Paul Bloom, that white people do feel this overbearing sense of anxiety, because when they're confronted with multiculturalism and they know that there are all of these rules that they have to follow or else they're a terrible racist person, it causes them a great deal of psychological turmoil. And this is just accepted as part and parcel and almost normal and good that white people should. So if they're able to get into a positive identity movement instead, that will make them feel a lot better. That's one of the benefits that we can get. But people would fight back against you if you even suggested that they should be able to feel good about themselves. So in your experience, again, as an Austrian, it's interesting to hear your experience, because you would have possibly even greater pushback on such a thing than we do in Britain. For people watching this, what kind of tips and pointers, advice can you give them to speak to somebody who they would like to help lift this burden from them? What's kind of worked with you when you've spoken to people about a positive view of themselves and their own history?
That's also a very important point. I write about this also in my book. There's a German psychologist, one of the major psychologists, and he released a study after his retirement, Professor Ulrich Schmidt-Denter, and this was a study also published in the journal about the effects of the Holocaust education, that's how you call this part of education, on Germans without a migration background. And he's done hundreds and thousands of in-depth interviews with young German students, and he showed that after this education starts, it also goes into slavery, crusades, you know, it's kind of a whole guilt education, the identification with the nation totally drops. And guilt rises, and there were questions like, if you were to be reborn, would you like to be reborn as a German? And 80% said no. didn't happen with Germans with migration backgrounds, with migrants. They're completely immune to that. So obviously, the German identity, community is completely shut down in a way and destroyed and atomized, while the identity of the migrants is being boosted. And it's happening systematically in Germany. And when you're maybe familiar with Jonathan Haidt, the psychologist who, The Righteous Mind, and he described these people, these weird people, these Western educated intellectual people who are lacking the moral framework for loyalty, ancestry, and the sacred. And these three moral arguments are being shut out. I would say it's not natural. It's being done systematically by white people to white people. And if we deal with this, especially with the very educated people who are brainwashed, I think we need to adapt something which I call therapeutical resistance. So we have to understand we're not dealing with somebody with different ideological position. We're dealing with somebody who has a severe psychological, I wouldn't say damage, but he has a handicap. Because the normal development, you know, when you grow up as a child, you discover your sexual identity, you discover your own self, and then the next step is the group identity. To have a healthy individual identity, you have to be part of a bigger and greater political group. That's obviously been the case. And this psychological development is willfully disturbed and destroyed for white European people, especially in Austria and Germany. So the way to deal with this has to be very soft, like very strategic, and piece by piece and part by part, try to lead people out of that. And one thing that has been proven successfully for me, as I said, I studied philosophy, so I was very deep into enemy territory, was to make people understand that actually what they're perpetuating with this ideology is still a kind of universalism. It's still kind of universalistic pride. It's called guilt pride in Germany because they're still proud. They still think they're superior. So they're not the superior biological people, but now they have a superior and unique guilt, which is not matched by any other people in the world. So still a very German way of thinking. And if people understand that this is a political religion, that this is not rational, that they have been brainwashed in a way, that they've been taught to think like that, then very often, once they're awakened, it's very easy for them to step out. So I would say, like, step by step, you have to make people understand that it's a huge ideology has been pushed upon them. It's a political religion. It's not a rational or moral mindset. And also, obviously, and that's something I also write about in the book, it's not even helping. It's not even helping the rest of the world. If white people destroy themselves by mass migration, like suicide, harakiri with third world replacement migration, it will not help the third world. It will not help Europe. It's a lose-lose situation for anyone. So it's also very, I would say, reckless and unfair to do this as white people, because we not only have good things to give to the world, we also have a responsibility to the world. And this responsibility doesn't mean to send our money anywhere, to import millions of non-Europeans. It means managing and helping to manage and contain the dangers that we also created, because we have created a whole modern world from AI to the internet to atomic bombs to very dangerous ideologies from liberalism to communism, fascism. All of this is a creation of white people. If white people now just opt out and leave the rest of the world with all these dangerous technological and psychological tools, I would also say it's very reckless. So appealing again, obviously, as an argumentative strategy to this idea of having a purpose that goes beyond ethnocentrism.
That's all very interesting. And when you say about how it doesn't benefit the rest of the world as well, one of the striking statistics that you cite near the end of your book is that I believe it was an African demographer was going around and asking people, a representative sample, if they would consider moving to Europe or outside of Africa. And about 70%, 70, 80% of the respondents all said that they would be interested of moving outside of Africa for economic reasons, for cultural reasons, for whatever reason given. And you have to ask yourself at that point, what does Africa even look like if not, let alone what does Europe look like if we have 200 million Africans, North and Sub-Saharan Africans, living on the continent? Never mind our infrastructure, our culture, all of the difficulties that it would lead to us, the increased crime and whatnot. What does Africa look like after that happens? What happens to the people who get left behind? Because that's not going to be elderly folk who aren't able to make the journey moving out. That's going to be young people. That's going to be young people who've possibly studied as doctors and such. This is a big problem in places like Nigeria. All of their doctors just moved to Europe and to Britain. Like, what happens to those countries? And at which point, like, you get into this bizarre train of thought where it's like, well, if all of Africa ends up just emptying itself out into Europe, to Europeans kind of reverse and just go like, there'll be massive contingents of Europeans who go, well, it's free real estate and move down to the tropics. And then do they all just start filtering back that way again when you end up with like a South Africa situation where you have like a potential nuclear power on the Horn of Africa, and then all of a sudden they all go, well, we want to work and live there. Like, you lead to some bizarre situations where you think of, or does everything just get worse and everybody lives in squalor for the rest of history? It's these bizarre thought experiments. But that's just something that crossed my mind then. Returning to your book, during your answer, you were mentioning people of non-migration background in Germany, which is just another ridiculous euphemism that we get for German people. And we don't quite have that yet in Britain, but I can imagine it developing in that direction. So in your book, on the question of the remigration policy and the actual logistics of it, you speak of who would qualify for remigration. And this is a very, very important question because we need to be clear about it for how we make our own plans and how we sell this to people as well when we are lobbying and when we are speaking to politicians and other influential people. And you identify three different types in your book, which is type A, which are asylum seekers. Immediately, obviously, they would need to have their claims reassessed. If their asylum claims are not accepted, they would just immediately be put onto the remigration list. You have other foreigners, and then you have group C, non-assimilated naturalized citizens, who clearly, because they have been naturalized, would be the most difficult. And this brings the question of, how does a migrant qualify as assimilated? How do you avoid accusations from the media and politicians about this being a purely biologically and racially discriminatory, bigoted policy on how you're qualifying assimilated? So can you tell the audience how assimilation qualifies, how you would be able to tell if somebody is assimilated, and the likelihoods of different peoples from different cultures assimilating into German or other European cultures?
Yeah, that's now we're going really to the core. First, foremost, my book has the subtitle A Proposal. So it's my proposal, my take on that, also formulated in the circumstance of German audience, German-Austrian situation, and obviously German-Austrian law. I think it's a very moderate proposal. And I understand that there are more severe, more hardcore remigration plans. I think it's absolutely valid. There needs to be an open debate between remigration advocates and between all different kinds of concepts. I was really thinking about naming this third group non-assimilated naturalized citizens, but I think a remigration concept that doesn't even talk about this problem is not serious, because we have the problem that our the boomer, the generations before us, have been mass naturalizing people who have nothing to do with this nation. So first, to understand the identitarian approach to assimilation, I think assimilation needs to be the goal of any kind of long-lasting immigration. But it doesn't mean, obviously, that everybody can be assimilated. It means that in the first place, if you want to get migrants here who are here to stay and in later term need to become citizens, you have to think in beforehand how much assimilation capacity you have in your nation for different nationals and different arrivals. And this differs absolutely between different cultures and backgrounds. We've seen this in America with the Immigration Act before the Hard Seller Act, where the Americans said, okay, yes, we want immigration, we also want assimilation. They didn't like Germans to stay German or Italians to stay Italian, but we want to preserve the demographic makeup of America, and that's why we have a fixed number, and then we have certain quotas for people from different nations who could come in. And I propose the same concept for every European nation. So we need to find out how much immigration do we want in the first place, a fixed number, and then this number, percentage, how much people we want from Scandinavia, from Italy, And obviously, we now have a perfect data set, an example of how much people we can stomach and take into our society. And we have made very bad experience with non-European migrants. And obviously here, there needs to be a total stop of migration, a stop of naturalization, I would say a process of remigration. And in this third group, I think there's kind of a heritage that we need to deal with, which we also cannot just get rid of. Because I stress it here, as in my book, every citizen has the rights, the same rights in front of the state. And you cannot just treat citizens differently based on a religious background or based on their appearance or based on any other criteria. If you promote this, it's very important to understand this, you might just as well promote a dictatorship, doing away with democracy and overthrowing the current system. Because this would take away isonomia, which is the basic idea of democracy, because everybody is equal in front of the law. So if I would promote this, then there could be a left-wing guy who would promote, yeah, we take away the right to vote for all the people who are don't have a democratic, a hateful mindset. So we have a database of people who have committed hate crimes, and all these people lose the right to vote. It would be, in a way, the same proposal. And if you start proposing taking away the right to vote or taking away the basic rights of citizens, of people who are citizens, then you are advocating for the destruction of this democratic system. If you want to do that, that's your choice, but you have to be very aware of that. I'm not for that. I have a reform, an evolutionary proposal. So remigration is very different from group A, B to C. And in group C, it does not involve deportations because I don't call for the deportations of citizens. But what I'm calling for is stopping the mass naturalization process, revoking the citizenships where it's possible for dual citizens or people who have been betraying the system. Just one example, in Germany, the socialists want to revoke citizenships up to 10 years after giving them out for people who are anti-Semitic. The SPD, the Socialist Party, said 10 years after you became a German citizen, we take it away if you show signs of anti-Semitism. Why not 20 years afterwards if you show signs of anti-German opinions? So there are a lot of ways to change the law here. But obviously, the most important point that I propose here, my proposal, is what I call in German Leitkultur, positive pressure. Pressure to either assimilate or to remigrate, and also voluntary incentives of people to go back to a different nation, to a different country, where they fit in culturally. And I think if you do this in the long term, so if you stop mass naturalization right now, today, and from tomorrow on, you have this inversion of push and pull factors. You have voluntary incentives of going to a different country, and you have economic and cultural pressure. These ghettos, these parallel societies, will slowly start to decrease. It will not happen in 1 year or 5 years, but I think maybe two or three decades. But it's also the time that it took for these parallel societies to develop. That's my proposal. I think it's absolutely doable, 100% within the frame of our constitutions. And I think it's also the most serious approach. But again, I'm okay with other people having a more severe or more light proposal when it comes to remigration.
Yeah, and on that kind of pushing people, lightly pushing people back through a positive cultural change. One of the interesting things is obviously near the end of the book, you give a few case studies and you say that they're not really applicable, but you show that it is possible for there to be a remigration without there being mass violence, because a lot of people worry that there's going to be civil war that breaks out, or that there's going to be some kind of mass violent pushback from these large populations of migrants who've come into our countries over the decades. And the example that you gave that seemed most relevant to this non-violent pushback was Fiji, which I wasn't actually aware quite before I read the example that you gave of Fiji, of just how far it had gone with the amount of Indians who had moved there following the following decolonization of the British Empire. Because, of course, we moved them over there as a form of labor. They stayed after decolonization. They brought their family members over. I didn't realize that they had gone quite so far as to be able to establish themselves as the ruling political majority by one point, before the native Fijians were able to reassert control and enact a peaceful, non-violent policy that meant that it went from being the majority demographic within Fiji to, I believe the figure that you gave in the book was 25-26%, which does show to people who are skeptical of the idea, who are perhaps blackpilling about our current situation, that there are examples of this sort of thing doing. What we want to avoid is it from turning into a situation like you point out in Algeria, with the French being pushed out of Algeria, which was a violent situation, which did lead to people being attacked and dying. That, I think everybody wants to avoid that, and we want to avoid the image of that. But onto some of the other proposals that went off of the back of that, you established the idea in chapter 5 of where these people would be held when they're on their way out. You would establish an assimilation department, I believe was the term. I might be getting the exact term for it wrong, but a department of government that would be able to look into these things and have objective criteria that they can assess by. And you also say that there would be model cities. You could get into like bilateral agreements with North African states to create model cities wherein people could work. They would be able to stay there for a number of years before returning to their home countries. This is particularly important, as you point out, for people of asylum, who are asylum seekers, where we are uncertain of their actual background. So we do not initially have a country to return them to. And you point out things like biometrics would be used to catalog these people and help to trace their backgrounds. Now, a lot of people might hear those sorts of proposals and be worried that you're ushering in, particularly with stuff like biometrics, people get very worried about this. Some kind of techno-feudalism, that these ideas of big organizations like Palantir, who want to use AI to catalog people, potentially control people through the data that they collect, that you'd just be giving them a leg up, that you would be they would be using remigration as a front to be able to get their agenda through. How would you address anybody who might have those kinds of concerns, so that they don't have to worry that that could be a potential in that situation?
No, I think it's the contrary. Why I mentioned biometric data is because these people always claim they've lost a passport or the dog ate their passport, and so there's no way to find out how old they are or where they actually come from. So we need borders and fences outside to have freedom inside. And I want to use all of this surveillance technology, drones, biometric data, fences for the outside to save our borders and to save our high-trust societies, that inside our high-trust societies, we need less surveillance and less of this techno-feudalism. But if you don't stop the demographic replacement, the ethnic fragmentation of a society, then we'll have it everywhere. Cameras everywhere, biometric data everywhere in our society, because we need to recreate the fences. We don't have the border within and between our own gated communities. And that's going to happen if we don't move the violence to control the checkpoints outside to our border. So I would say no, on the contrary. By doing this, we prevent our society from becoming this low-trust society, this atomized society that then needs police control everywhere and surveillance everywhere. And just to rectify this, I was talking about a demographics and assimilation monitor, because the problem is at the moment, we don't have the data. We don't know how many people came. We don't really know when the tipping point will happen. We don't know how these migrants affected the economy. The study we know from Denmark, where they really broke down the contribution, the net contribution for every migrant group, has to be done in every European nation. The data is available, it's there, but it's just hidden from us. So the first task for any right-wing government is to have a clear data set. We need to crunch all the numbers. We need to see exactly what migration did to our nation in the past decades, because we need this data to make a good decision for the future. And then remigration can really start with measured numbers and with a clear plan. Because a lot of those things in my book have to be speculation, because they're just hiding all the numbers from us. And these model cities you mentioned, I was not too radical by bringing them up. I was too early, because just recently in the European Parliament, they made a vote, and they had a majority, the conservatives and the right-wing populists, for so-called return hubs. And I have to admit, return hub sounds nicer than model city. It sounds way sleeker and more,
the bureaucrats, they're used to coming up with the ultimate neutral sounding euphemisms for everything.
Return hub. So I'm absolutely for it. I'll also use this term from now on. And the return hub is nothing else but creating a golden bridge out. Because remigration will not be violent at all if you create a better opportunity in the homeland or in a return hub and then create pressure here. Because I would say 99.9% of migrants who came to Europe for economic reasons. They couldn't care less about British politics. They couldn't care less about German culture, Italian cuisine. They came here solely for economic reasons. And that's why there will be also an early mover bonus for countries who start remigration first. So, for example, if Austria starts remigration before Germany, you only need to slightly invert the push and pull factors, and a majority of the illegals, of the non-contributing migrants or even non-assimilated citizens will leave to Germany because there's a huge inter-European mobility of migrants who are here, and this already shows that they have no real connection to the land, to the culture. They just go where they get the most benefit from the system. And if you reduce the benefit and you create a different offer by moving to a return hub or to the homeland, many people will take this offer. And those who really don't do it, some of them might stay and really assimilate. So I don't cross this out at all. It will happen. But you need to create the circumstances where we keep our ethno-cultural continuity, where indigenous Europeans stay the dominating majority in the nations, because without that, what's even the point of a British parliament, of a German parliament, without a British or a German people?
Yeah, that's great. And that's good to hear about the surveillance, because I think that should help to alleviate some people's worries regarding that. Because there is an argument to be made as well that by destabilizing society to the extent that it has been part of the push for mass surveillance states, because it justifies it, because it allows them to say, well, crime rates are up so much, there are so many more assaults, particularly on women, we have all of this chaos through society, so we're going to need to implement a kind of 1984 Orwellian state. But also, you mentioned the economics of it, that the Denmark study showed that for basically anybody who isn't an inter-European migrant, that they're For Denmark, at least, then you would expect that this would be similarly replicated across most of Europe. And we, like you say, we have these figures, they just don't release them to us or they hide them away from us within other figures. That there's basically no economic benefit to a lot of these people coming because they cost the state money. And you're starting to see positive developments within the within Europe, where, as you mentioned, they're starting to set up these return hubs, which does suggest that there is even within bureaucrats an appetite for this. What do you say to big business having been part of the reason for these people being brought in as an attempt to expand the labor pool, to decrease labor costs and to weaken unions? I've been reading an interesting book recently which pointed out that in the 1980s in Britain you had Margaret Thatcher crushing the unions, and then 10 years later you have Tony Blair starting to open the floodgates for mass immigration into this country, which do seem to be a continuity of one another, because all of a sudden you have the economic argument. Well, we need these people because they're not doing these jobs that you don't do anymore. And the reason you're not doing these jobs is because you smashed the unions and made it so that these jobs are economically unviable for people. And following Brexit, we had people like Lord Wolfson arguing that we needed migrants from all across the Commonwealth, and that was one of the reasons that he was for Brexit after we left the European Union. Does there need to be some kind of agreement entered into with business? We obviously have the public-private partnership in a lot of governments across the West right now. Does that partnership need to be adjusted so that business knows that it can have a certain degree of freedom without having as much influence to bring these people in to benefit their own bottom line at the expense of the nation?
Absolutely. I think that's a power of the concept of remigration. It's also against legal replacement migration. Not only talks about the GDP, but also about the cultural cost, the cost to the social capital. I'm sure you're aware with this term and the study of Robert Putnam, of mass migration. It costs, it has a social cost, a community cost. Diversity, ethnic diversity, has a lot of negative side effects the lower class, the middle class, suffers from, and not the anywheres, the people who can move everywhere and who are, as Collier wrote in his book Exodus, parasitic in the nature to these societies and to their social capital. And it's also very interesting you mentioned Thatcher. The same thing, the very same thing happened in Germany and Austria. There were two betrayals. The first betrayal by the conservatives. They brought in the guest workers to crush the socialists and to crush the workers' unions. And then the socialists naturalized all of them to get new voters in, make them dependent on tax money. Two acts of betrayal, both in their own interest, both against the British and against the German people. And here's another very important argument that people should really learn by heart for conversations with advocates of legal immigration. It's the most inhumane and the most unfair thing you can do, because for these few really skilled migrants you're getting in, you're destroying their homelands. It's demographic vampirism. Because for every one skilled laborer who leaves a poor country, you're destroying the workplace of 10 unskilled laborers. And in London, you have more Liberian doctors than in all of Liberia, in Zimbabwe, former Rhodesia. 70 to 80% of doctors who are educated there leave the nation. So obviously, if all my doctors leave my nation, I, as an unskilled laborer, will follow those doctors. So it's the most inhumane thing you can do to actually take legal contributing migrants in if you want to help people at place and if you want to stop these huge flows of mass migration. And I think here we have to take into consideration that a nation isn't just its GDP. It's not just an economic zone. It has an ethno-cultural continuity. And this ethno-cultural continuity has a value in itself, which goes way beyond the GDP. And even if a certain decision, when you look at the comparative costs, might be bad for the GDP, but it safeguards the ethno-cultural identity on the long term, this is the responsible decision to make for a politician. And that's why I'm a proud identitarian, because I think the ethno-cultural identity is the basis, and then economy comes in second. So to answer this question, yeah, I think that also legal migration and also the business and also the great enterprises had played a very important negative role here, not only communists and socialists, but again, it's white guilt, again, what it comes down to, because we also have those businesses in Japan. We also have a trade union in Japan, and they all always want to get more migrants in the businesses. But there you don't have this self-hatred, and the national consensus there is we want to stay Japanese. So again, coming back to white guilt as the root cause.
Yeah, you are starting to see some kind of complaint of more migrants being brought in with Japan, but they have a much more robust defense mechanism than so much of Europe has had for such a long time. They immediately all just like all at the same time were just like, they start to see a trickle of like 3,000 Kurds come into the country and they go, nope, we don't want any more of that. And they start voting in such a way to try and prevent that from continuing in the future. Sorry, I've lost my train. I lost my train of thought for a moment. Then, so we're going to wrap up in a moment. So before we do, what do you currently see as the greatest challenges facing remigration efforts across all of Europe, and what can the people watching this right now start to do to improve the situation, to start organizing, and to start making a positive change?
So I would say that the biggest problem we have is the lack of time. So yeah, the ideological pendulum is moving in our direction. Woke is cringe, woke is over. The new generation that comes now, the Zoomers are way more right-wing. But the problem is the Zoomers already are in the minority. So if you take away the Boomers, we already are a multi-ethnic state, which is dominated by an Islamic majority soon to come. So that's the fact, at least for Germany, for Belgium, for France, for Austria, not so much for Italy. I don't know the exact numbers for the UK, but I think it's rather similar, at least in the urban centers. Mm. So whether we like it or not, we need the Boomers. So we need their votes, we need the resources. And I think only if we can organize the majority we still have right now for the next 10, 15 years until the Boomers have passed, we can reconquer our states, our institutions. We can pull the lever close the gates, start remigration, and keep our civilization. If we miss this one chance, these states get slipped out of our grasp and these states will turn into prisons for us, like South Africa has turned into a hostile prison for white people because the state will be ruled by an Islamo-communistic migration coalition together with big business against the last white people. And then we only can create our own little communities like the Amish, like the Mormons, or maybe even flee those death zones and try to establish new colonies somewhere else. So that's the big picture. And that's why I think the biggest obstacle, the biggest problem that we have is time pressure. And that's why even more so we now have to come together and to organize the resources we have right now. So what we need is more organization, more strategy. So I would urge everybody who watches this video to consider his own life, the place he is in life, what in the next 10 to 15 years will happen in his life, and then see how he can contribute to this cause. Maybe he can make an education to become more valuable. Maybe he already has a valuable education, connections, resources, and money, and then to see how he can contribute in media, in theory, in activism, in party politics, in counterculture. We need everybody, and even if you don't have a skill on your own, you can still support other movements financially with advice and with network. So this mindset, I think, is the most important people have. It's not somewhere in the future, it's now. And every day that's gone, every week that's gone, every year that's gone is lost. It will never come back again. And I've tried to also create a strategy. I've written a book, it's called Right-Wing Regime Change, where I also describe the five parts of the right-wing movement. And I think the most important thing that everybody can do is to really make an introspection to see where are my talents, what can I do, and how can I contribute to the cause right now, and how can I adjust my life in the next 10 to 15 years to give everything I have, to don't miss this last biggest chance of a generation to save this, this civilization and to reconquer our own states. Because I don't think it's only the last chance, it's also the greatest chance ever we ever had since the Second World War for real political and cultural change across Europe.
Certainly, and it will give people's lives a bit more meaning if they're able to throw themselves into this rather than just being the consumers, the mindless consumers that globalism and modernity is trying to make us into. So, Martin, what's the next steps for you? Where can people find you and how can they support you right now?
Next step, when I'm recording this video, will be the Remigration Summit in Porto. I don't know when it's broadcasted, but you're going to find all the speeches we gave there online. And I'm in the process of setting up the Institute for Immigration, which will be an NRA-styled lobby, research, policy, think tank around the idea of remigration. And also, I think when you're watching the video, it's already online, we're going to start a big project, a big initiative on the European level, a patriotic initiative, where everybody also is invited to take part in. And we want to unite with this, the whole remigration movement, the patriotic movement in Europe. And you can find all of those links and all those necessary steps on my X profile, Martin Sellner on X. And there you find all the information to also get involved and get active.
Fantastic. And please, if you're interested, it's well worth a read. It's very interesting. It's very German and Austria focused, but it has lots of information and lots of strategies that can be applied outside of a German and Austrian perspective as well. You can pick up Martin's newest book, Remigration, in its first English translation from Passage Press and other reputable sales vendors online as of the 26th of May, which will probably have already passed by the time that this video goes out. So you'll be able to pick it up right now. Martin, thank you very, very much for joining me. I've really enjoyed this conversation.
Thank you, me too. It was an amazing conversation. Very deep questions, very amazing preparation. You don't see this very often online, so I would be happy to come back again. And thank you also for preventing me from shilling for my own book. Yeah, but buy it and read it.
That's all right. I just try and do what little I can so that I'm not wasting your time and the audience's. So thank you to everyone who's joined us for this discussion. Take care, and I hope you've taken something useful from this that you can put into your own life as well. Till next time, we'll see you then. Goodbye.
Thanks. Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you want to get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.
Hi everyone, this is James and Dan. We are two-fourths of the hit UK podcast, No Such Thing as a Fish.
That's right. Every week we sit down behind some microphones and share with each other the best things we've found out over the last 7 days.
Yes, so for instance, Dan, did you know that you cannot tie a knot in 4 dimensions?
I knew that's where I was going wrong. Interesting.
There are all sorts of reasons why, but we would go into them all on our podcast, along with loads of extra facts as well.
That's right. And if you want to check it out, No Such Thing as a Fish is available wherever you get your podcasts.